I'm going to give the first talk. My name is Patrick Hayden, and I'm going to be describing some joint work, the title of which is Holographic Duality from Random Tensor Networks. Yesterday, at least to those of you on the email list, I sent around a copy of the draft of the paper. So if you want to learn more about the details, you're welcome to look inside. It's a paper with a cast of, if not thousands, then six. And three of the authors are here, Sepper Nizami, Michael Walter, over there, Xiaoliang Qi, Nate Thomas, and Zhao Yang. So what we're going to do this morning, we're going to take about a couple of hours, maybe a little bit more, and we've divided up some of the material in the paper between the three of us who are actually present. I'll start with the introduction, and then we'll move on from there. So the setting is that we're discussing essentially toy models for holography. And this is going to, we're essentially building on the work that was described yesterday, the HAPI paper. Harlow, Pastowski, Preskill, Yoshida. It was developing a toy model for holography. And their idea, or at least the way that they made this work, is they used a particular six-index tensor that had these nice properties. So they called it a perfect tensor. And so if you looked at any three of the six indices, or rather, if you thought of this as a quantum state, and you partitioned, you thought of it as a quantum state with six indices, so with six subsystems, then any three of the subsystems was maximally entangled with any three of the others. And that's sort of the engine that made their construction work. And by gluing together such things, so for example, by thinking of the tensor as a hexagonal tile and tiling the hyperbolic plane, they were able to recover a number of features of the holographic correspondence. So in particular, if they did this and tiled the hyperbolic plane with these hexagons, then you would be left with uncontracted indices only out at the boundary. And they could calculate the entropies of regions on the boundary. And what they found was that they got the Ryu-Takayanagi formula for boundary intervals. So I'm just reviewing, of course, what you heard yesterday. But for the purpose of contrasting what we're able to do today with what was in this previous work. So they get the Ryu-Takayanagi formula for intervals, and they get the right answer for certain sets that are not intervals on the boundary. But there are cases where the Ryu-Takayanagi formula breaks down.
Can I just ask an elementary question? Is one index out of the plane?
I'm about to talk about that. At the moment, no.
The reason I ask the question is the hexagon tiles the Euclidean plane, not the hyperbolic plane.
Well, they're not regular hexagons.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Forward
around the vertex. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, what they then do though, is they think of a slightly different model. Pentagons. Like so, and then they do take one index out into the plane. So then they can think of these as creating a map from the bulk, the interior, to the boundary. And what this allows them to do is to push bulk, we'll call them logical operators, in the language of quantum error correction that was discussed yesterday, out to the boundary. All right, so this generates the kind, this was really one of the nice insights, or rather, this was the manifestation of the earlier paper with Harlow, Chidong, and Almeri, identifying a quantum error correction character in the holographic correspondence, or an ADS-CFT. So in the first case, they get Ryu-Takayanagi only for intervals. And so if you have more general boundary sets, this might be a case that works, I'm not sure, in which the minimal surface, so it looks like this. That's not a great job. in which the minimal surface looks like this, there will be circumstances where the algorithm they use to reconstruct the entropy in the boundary state will actually give you a lower entropy than you would want for the Ryutaki-Nagi formula. And likewise, if you're trying to push operators out to the boundary, if you're in such a situation, you have some bulk operator deep inside, and you want to ask the question, can I push the operator out to this boundary region, which is not a not an interval, then you might their algorithm might say that it looks like it's not possible, or they might even conclude that it is provably not possible, even though you might hope that that it would be possible and that this operator is inside the entanglement wedge from the point of view of Ryutaki-Nagi, inside the region connected to the boundary if you find the minimal surface in the bulk. So basically what I want to do today is, or what we will collectively do today, is present a model. Again, it's a toy model for holography, in which these questions are resolved, in which we get Ryutaki-Nagi for all boundary regions, and in which we're able to push out all operators inside the entanglement wedge to the boundary properly. So what we'll get is, number one, we get that. Number two, we get that. And the construction, or at least the general approach, is not specific to a two-dimensional bulk, and so we can go to higher dimensions. And it's not really specific to the hyperbolic plane, and so it could be useful for thinking about holography in more general settings. So the way we're going to break this down, I'll at least talk about what we mean by these random tensor network states, and I'll explain where the Ryutaki-Nagi formula comes from. And it turns out that we can interpret, or we can sort of see where Ryutaki-Nagi is coming from by mapping the question of the entropy onto the calculation of some free energies in a ferromagnetic Ising model. And so there's a sort of nice little picture there that we'll discuss. And then I'll hand it off to Sepper, and he'll talk about, what happens if you insert some bulk fields in this model. You need corrections to Ryutaki-Nagi, and we get the expected form of the corrections that you would want. And in that picture, he can also talk about the quantum error correcting codes, and so this number two. So I'll get one, he'll get two. And there's also something analogous to the Hawking-Page transition that happens. So he'll talk about Hawking-Page. And then Michael Walter, we'll bat cleanup, and he's actually going to talk about the relationship between bulk and boundary correlation functions. So what he's going to be able to argue to you, I think, he just landed from Zurich last night, so I'm not 100% sure what he's going to say, but that you find a structure in the boundary correlation functions, which is what you would expect in a holographic theory. In particular, for this theory, we can work out the scaling dimensions, and you find a gap in the scaling dimensions, which is of the type which is a necessary condition for holography to work. So this is all very nice, and I find quite exciting. But before we get into it in too much detail, it's worth pausing for a little bit and just thinking about what is being done here and what's not being done here. So we're going to be thinking about a model in which there's a fixed tensor network. And so the origin of the tensor network is a mystery at this point. There's no dynamics in the model, right? So we don't really have a Hamiltonian. And so this is a big defect. And while we gain quite a bit, relative to the earlier work, we also lose something, which is, as you'll see, the tensor network construction that we use breaks every symmetry possible, right? Our tensors are all chosen independently, and so while there's some distributional symmetry in the model, an actual instantiation has essentially no symmetry at all. And so there's a give and take here, and there's certainly a long way to go.
Wasn't there also an issue with Rangi entropies?
There will be a, yeah, so there'll be an issue with Rangi entropies, which is that rather than varying with the Renyi parameter as they should in actual ADS-DFT, they're all going to be essentially the same up to the bulk corrections. Some additional structure is clearly required. Like there's, in some ways, this model is too simple and too perfect. And I guess just, you know, perhaps this is something that we can discuss, you know, during the breaks or at the end. But from my own perspective, I'm very much unsure of how, you know, what we're trying to learn from these tensor network models. So at the very least, one thing that we can learn, or one way we can treat this, is that these are simply toy models for holography. And if we're puzzled by some of the conceptual features of ADS-CFT, by working in these settings in which we can calculate everything and we can really see exactly what's going on explicitly, then maybe we can gain some understanding that extends to the full models, or to the real situation. They maybe have more flexibility on some axes than ADS-CFT, so they could guide us towards potentially how to extend the duality. And it's conceivable that properly generalized, they do generate, you know, they will be the basis for some theories of quantum gravity, but we're certainly nowhere near that point. So right now, I think we're really just talking about toy models of various types. All right, so what is the model? So random tensor states. The way that I'm going to think about these things, I'm going to take a bunch of maximally entangled states. So one of these objects here is just a maximally entangled state. I'll write this phi plus of a pair of d-dimensional Hilbert spaces. And so I'm going to think of a state in which I start off with just a bunch of these Bell pairs. Maybe something like this. And then I'm going to group some of the indices. Maybe I want some colors here. So in this picture, I have some boundary indices that aren't grouped together with any others, or rather some boundary vertices. And I have some, we'll think of them as bulk indices, that are actually grouped and contracted with some of the other vertices. So I'll now start labeling these things. So for my boundary vertices, I'm going to break them into two parts just for what's going forward. So I've labeled some of the boundary vertices that aren't grouped with any others. And then internally, in the bulk, here I have three additional vertices. And to construct my state, I'm going to take all of these Bell pairs, and in the bulk, for the bulk vertices, I'm going to contract those indices with a random tensor, a random state. So in here, we're going to contract with a random tensor. And just to get us warmed up, and some of you will have seen this calculation already, but I think it's useful for what comes in the next two talks. So I'm going to go through this little calculation. The kind of thing we're interested in, and it's going to be the foundation for all the calculations that we're going to do afterwards, is what is the, if we think of this now as a quantum state after we've contracted these internal indices, what is the entropy of some subset of the boundary vertices? Like, what is the entropy of the A's? And this is an easy calculation. Yeah?
Are the graphs that you consider always planar?
They don't need to be, no. And certainly if you want to go to higher dimensions, it would be, yeah. It would be very difficult to make them planar.
Can you say more what you mean by random? Like, is it
yeah, I will. Yeah. Yeah, for the moment, let's just say that these are distributed according to the unitarily invariant measure with the unitarily invariant measure on. They're going to be quantum states. Like the way that I'm going to contract is by taking a Brauniquet.
I'm just the Hilbert space of all the indices.
Yeah. You could.
Answered
again. There are other things that you could do. But for the moment, we're just going to do that simple thing. So to do this calculation, it's helpful to first just write down a symbol for the quantum state before we contract, right? So there's going to be some omega ABC, which will just be the tensor product over all the edges of those bell pairs, right? So that's one state. And then the contracted state, we'll call it rho. It has A and B parts, because the C's are all contracted, but the A's are left behind. And the way that we get that is I'm just going to take a bunch of random quantum states, Cn, ABC, like so. And those will all be chosen independently according to the unitarily invariant measure for the moment. And this is the definition of my quantum state rho AB, right? And these inner products, partial inner products, give us the contractions that we need internally. So to calculate an entropy.
So Patrick, that's not obviously the same as choosing that state randomly amongst the unitary all the systems together. Is that right?
A unitary. Oh, like it's different than if I'd chosen these with a single unitary rather than independently.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. That's a different model.
Is it important which one?
Well, for the calculations we're going to do today, yes, it is important. And I suspect, but we haven't verified, that if you make, like these are d by d, that if you make d large enough, my suspicion is that you'll get the same kinds of statistics, but we haven't verified that. It would be worth doing because that would restore some of the symmetry that we broke in here, right? So it's a calculation that would be worth doing. But it's rather than a calculator, you'll see to calculate the Renyi 2 entropy, which we're going to do, we just have to calculate some averages that are degree 2 in U and U bar, this unitary. If we make these the same unitary, then it's going to be degree 2n or 4n, in this thing. So it's just a bigger, more complicated average. But we should find out what happens.
Yeah. Hey, sorry, were the phi ij's also chosen randomly, or are they fixed?
No, they're just bell pairs in some fixed basis.
And they're maximally.
I mean, actually the basis doesn't matter, right? Because it absorbed into the averaging here. Other questions?
The structure of the graph you pick ahead of time.
Yes, the structure of the graph we pick ahead of time. So this omega basically determines the features of the model, and so we might want to start off with a graph corresponding to this situation. We're going to think about graphs corresponding to things like this. But it could, we could think of this, on a square lattice with some uncontracted boundary edges. There are all kinds of different possibilities.
If you consider the case where the entangled bell pairs aren't maximally mixed, but
yes. Were you asking if we have worked it out?
Have you? Yes.
Have we worked it out? Let's see. At some level, I think we have, although we haven't really organized the answer, because we're going to work out ultimately a more general situation in which we have some bulk fields, and some bulk fields are just some general, rather than starting off with this general quantum or this specific quantum state in which you have a bunch of bell pairs, it's just an arbitrary quantum state. So I think it's subsumed by what's going to come later. Yeah. All right. So let's actually just work this out. So as I said before, we're going to calculate an entropy, but a good surrogate for the entropy is the Renyi 2 entropy, which is minus the log of trace rho A squared, because this is the easiest entropy-type quantity that you could ever hope to calculate. And by rho A here, I mean the density operator associated with taking this rho AB quantum state and tracing over B. Right? So that's what I'm looking at. And so we're going to want to calculate the expectation of this averaged over the different choices of the random quantum states. So the usual replica trick, what we do is we say we're going to take two copies of rho, and we're going to stitch them together appropriately with an operator that swaps the two copies of the A system. Right, so there's an A and a B system for the first copy of rho, an A and a B system for the second copy of rho. If we take the operator that swaps the two A systems, then that's just another way of writing the trace of rho A squared. say A tends to A. And this is really an easy calculation. This is why, you know, I usually don't do calculations at the board, but it's so easy, and it illustrates what's going on that I've, and some of you have seen this before, but I'm going to do it, you know, perhaps for the nearly last time. So we're just going to substitute in for rho here. So we have two copies of the omega state. And we have two copies each of the random states that we're using to contract. So we'll have a tensor product over I of psi ci 2, and then the slop. So this is what we're trying to calculate. And when we write it this way, we see that omega, of course, is independent of the choice of random quantum state. The swap operator is independent. So what we're really averaging is just the size themselves, right? So we can take this expectation value and just apply it to the product of the psi states. And of course, they're all independent of each other for different i's. And so what we're really just asking is, what is the average of a psi tensor psi? Right? So this is an object that has to be invariant under permuting the two copies. And it works out that it's actually just the projector onto the subspace, which is invariant under swapping. So this is the this works out to be the trace of omega ABC, let's say proportional to, I'm going to leave behind the normalization constant, well, the product over I's, the identity plus the swap. So a way of seeing what's going on here, this object for a particular I, it has to commute with U tensor U for all U, right? Because you're averaging over U tensor U. And so what commutes with U tensor U for all U? The identity does, and the operator that swaps the two copies of U, and nothing else. So it has to be a linear combination of these two operators, and the particular linear combination is just the equal linear combination. And this is nothing other than, as I said, the projector onto the subspace, which is invariant. So this is what we have. And I'd like to write it in a slightly different way. We're two lines away, essentially, from Ryu Takayanagi. So this is a product over all i's. For each I, we have two choices. Right? So this is going to be a sum over all subsets of the different possible i's. So we'll say a sum over all subsets, 1 through n, of the trace omega ABC, and then now the swap on A and all the C's in the subset. Right? Because if I swap the first C and the third C and the fifth C, right, then that's just swapping a collection of C's, right? So let's write it that way. But now we're back to the replica trick, right? We have two copies of a quantum state, and then we have a swap operator. Right? So this is, again, it's a purity, right? But it's actually a big sum over different purities. So a sum over the different i's of the trace of omega A C I squared. So what we've managed to do here, we've done the random averaging, and we've worked out that this entropic quantity is itself a sum of entropic-like quantities, right? And all we need to do is figure out, what is this actually equal to, and which term dominates the sum, if any. So, how do I want to?
So, what exactly are you swapping?
What am I swapping? So, let's start in this case up here, right? So here, there's an A system and a B system, and an A system and a B system, right?
A prime, B prime, or something.
Or actually, and even a C system. Well, I'll call them primes, sure. Right? So A and A prime are isomorphic, right? And A swaps the A and the A prime.
Two copies of the whole thing.
The whole thing,
Yeah.
Yeah. So it just swaps the tensor factors. Mm-hmm. So down here, the omega state is composed. The omega state has A stuff, C stuff, and B stuff, right? And so what I'm doing is I'm swapping the A's and a subset of the C's with their primed counterparts. So it's exact. I mean, it really is the two-copy replica trick for calculating the purity. That makes sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Feel free to ask further. Okay, so sorry about that.
So when you swap them, you're just swapping the unitaries that happen. So I just imagine two copies of this diagram. Each blue circle is a unitary, and then the swap switch unitaries in each one.
I'm swapping. I'm applying the swap to this psi, right?
Psi.
I mean, there's not actually explicitly a unitary anywhere, right? I mean, unless you want, you can say psi is defined as you acting on a fixed quantum state.
Yeah, so yeah. You swap the states.
Yeah. You just swap the states, yeah.
And they're only connected
and of course,
by that swap.
So you're writing trace, but there's two traces involved, because there's the trace that is involved in the definition of row A, and then there's the trace over A.
Oh, okay. No, there's only one trace.
That's a trace over everybody?
So row, I should say, this row here is row ABC.
That's row ABC.
It's the whole row, right? So, but my swap operator is only acting on the AA prime subsystem, uh-huh. Right? So if you wanted, I could have written this as an operator on A tensored with the identity elsewhere, mm-hmm. Right? So,
Yeah, I see. Okay.
Maybe
you
should say explicitly.
Around.
Maybe you should say explicitly that this is the swap test. Right? I mean, this is underlying.
Right. So if people are familiar with the language, this is the swap test for the calculation that appears in the swap test.
Yeah,
if you want to determine whether the state row is pure or not. Yeah.
So Patrick.
Yeah.
So in this case, actually, so since we are considering two copies, we just need.
This is just to start off. Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm just going to do two copies, mm-hmm. But Michael down here, I suspect, is going to tell you something about the higher Renyi entropies. Like a similar kind of calculation works, but it's more complicated, right? So I just wanted to get people familiar. Like the spirit of what's going on is all here.
In this case, I only need unitary two design.
You only need a two design. Okay. Yeah, yeah, and we'll make that that
point. The statement that you didn't need harvest. Too strong, or it was could weaken it.
Well, so for a lot of what's going to be said today, so for what I'm saying right now, we could get by with something much weaker than Har, but say down here, I guess only for what Michael's going to say, higher Renyi entropies and so on, and examining these correlation functions, you end up looking at higher moments, and so you need You wouldn't be able to get by with just a two design. You would need something more sophisticated.
Let me just make sure I understand the last line. So the sum is over all the ways that partitions C into two.
Exactly.
That corresponds to A. That corresponds to A bar or B.
Or B. Yeah. So exactly that you basically assign some of the C vertices to A, and you could think of you could think at least in an imaginary way assign the other C vertices to B. And then we'll work this out. This is actually the weight of the cut between A and B. So
I'm still being stupid about these lines. So psi is a state, but then you replaced it with an operator, this identity plus.
It's a density operator.
It's
a density operator, right?
So there's a cat bra.
Cat bra. Yeah. So sorry, I guess I mentioned that when I was defining these things here, but so all the way through. If I had a bra and I just remove the the flag, then what I just mean is the operator.
If it's unitary two design for this Renyi two purpose, can I just choose like random stabilizers?
We'll get there. Yes, you can, and something interesting happens. Yeah. All right. So I'll just actually rewrite this exactly the same thing, but slightly different notation, because I think we'll use this slightly different notation. So the trace of omega gamma A squared.
One final thing, Patrick.
Yep.
You mean rho A, B, and rho A, B cross rho A prime, B prime. There's no C.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. There's a C in omega, but not rho. Yeah. Okay, so gamma A is just, as we were saying before, a subset of vertices containing A but not B. Right? That's just another way of saying here I had some vertices that include A and they include some C's. Right? So just other language. I'm just going to call that set that collectively gamma A. So what is this purity, right? Let's go back to our picture. So we want a subset of vertices that contain all the A's and some of the C's, right? So maybe I'll choose this subset here. And we ask, what is the purity of this quantum state? Well, any Bell pair that's completely contained inside the pink doesn't contribute any entropy because that's a pure factor of the state. The only ones that contribute, well, anyone that is outside obviously doesn't contribute. The only ones that contribute are Bell pairs that cross between A and its complement, or not gamma A and its complement. And those contribute a 1 over D to the purity, right? They contribute log D entropy. So what this is actually equal to is a sum over gamma A of a d to the minus size of the cut, like so, right? So if I ask, what is the, this notation here, it's not great notation, but what I mean here is the size of the cut separating gamma A from its complement, right, in the graph. And so this is the kind of quantity that should appear in Ryu Takayanagi, right? That it is essentially the number of bonds that some curve in the bulk crosses, right? And what we do is what this formula looks like is we sum over all possible curves in the bulk the number of bonds that are cut by that curve, right?
It seems like there's a phase transition here in D, right?
There is. It's the icing ferromagnetic ordered phase transition, precisely. Yeah. So I'll get to exactly what that is. But there is a phase transition. So in this formula, if D is sufficiently large, what you would expect is that the smallest, there will be one dominant contribution, and it'll be the one where the size of the cut is smallest, right? Which corresponds to the minimal surface in the bulk. So let's say as N, which with our name for log D, goes to infinity, we expect the min over gamma A to dominate. And this is something that we can actually, we can analyze and prove that the entropy S2 of rho A is going to be equal to the size of the cut times this n, which is log d, plus something that goes to 0 with n of high probability. Right? And this really is the Ryu Takayanagi formula. It's Ryu Takayanagi if we put in the min over gamma A, right? So if we look at, minimizing over subsets of the bulk is roughly the same thing, sort of more general, than defining a curve in the bulk, right? And so what we're really doing is asking, find the curve that crosses the minimal number of bonds in the bulk, right? So if you had a surface and you triangulated the surface and then on each edge you put a Bell pair like this, right, you then get an approximation to the length or the area of the minimal surface in the bulk.
Sorry, as you say, choosing a subset is kind of generalizing the notion of the curve.
It is generalizing.
Always looks more like a curve?
The answer under reasonable hypotheses is going to be yes, although I'm not sure if I can make that totally precise. Like there are graphs that won't be geometrical at all, in which case the only thing that makes sense to discuss is this thing. So if you have a graph which you can embed into some surface, then again, I would have to pause a little bit just to think about exactly what hypotheses are going to be required, like maybe on the embedding.
It's important that you're talking about planar graphs anyway, because if you're in higher dimensions, you wouldn't be talking about curves. You'd be talking about surfaces.
But it's not really important. I've just been using the language of talking about curves, right? But if we're in higher dimensions, it just becomes a surface.
It automatically includes homology. That's how we should have been thinking about it in the first place. Instead of the surface, it's some way of dividing the space into two pieces.
Yeah, I think so. A cut is the right term. Yeah. In any dimension.
Yeah.
So you're always fixing the graph, and this is minimizing over the vertices within a given graph. Okay, so you're not imagining anything like a continuum limit, where you take the number of vertices large and...
It
would be a very crude approximation to...
Well, you certainly can think about a continuum limit. There's nothing stopping you from doing that, and you will get a continuum approximation. Like, if you take some net of points on the surface sufficiently dense that you start approximating the metric well. There's no problem with doing that. All right, so we have Ryu Takayanagi. Yes?
This model, Ryu Takayanagi, is working better than ABS-EFT in the sense that it predicts the second leading entropy in terms of the area of some minimal surface. Whereas in ABS-EFT, the second leading entropy is not given by the area of the minimal surface.
Better or worse, right? I mean, in ABS-CFT, the answer is what it is, and it is presumably the right answer, right? Aaron had made this point in a previous talk that, I guess we're only talking about the second Renyi entropy here. I think Michael will mention, if you calculate the higher Renyi entropies, you still get the same formula. So they're all the same, which is not the case in ADS-CFT. All right.
So does that mean that in this particular state, if I talk about, let's choose A to be just one point on the boundary, mm-hmm. and B to be another point, maybe far away from the first point.
Okay.
And I can ask about the mutual information mm-hmm. between the two. And I can ask about the second Renyi mutual information.
Yeah.
So the prediction is in this model is exactly zero.
Yes. That the only contribution to that mutual information will be from the bulk fields. I haven't introduced bulk fields yet, but maybe it's worth just mentioning. Sepper's going to talk more about this. In this model, I've called the vertices that are not inside the blue circle's boundary vertices. But in the calculation, I could also have allocated some of them to be bulk vertices, like over here, right? And so exactly the same calculation is going to apply. And so we'll be able to reinterpret this calculation in a setting in which you have both bulk and boundary vertices uncontracted.
Having the same Renyi entropies means that all the non-zero eigenvalues are equal, or
well, they're not exactly equal because the fluctuation terms vary, as a function of the Renyi parameter. But it means that they're very tightly concentrated, more tightly concentrated than they are in a CFT entanglement spectrum.
And this is just an artifact of
using exact bell pairs here.
Presumably that would.
Be exactly. That we can actually see exactly what happens if we replace this phi plus. By a CFT state, just split it in half somewhere, then what would come up would be here. Instead of D, what we'd have is the Renyi entropy of that CFT state, right? And so we'd get, in the rest of the calculation, we get the right scale. It would then vary properly with the Renyi parameter. So it's an artifact.
So I'm curious about the subleading correction that you get there. Does that show up in other Ryu-Takanaki derivations? For instance, the curvature around the minimal surface would affect how strong those secondary corrections are.
Yes. So in this language, so that's exactly true. So the here we have this sum, and you could imagine a situation, for example, in which there are actually multiple degenerate minimal surfaces.
Well, I wasn't thinking of degenerate, but a little more of a stationary phase approximation.
Right. No. But so I was just sort of for others here that in that case you're going to have to have some correction here owing to the degeneracy. But more generally, if the curvature is small, then you also expect a correction. Now, Michael, I think, may speak a little bit about the structure of the corrections. I'm not sure that we don't know exactly what the form of this function is. Is that correct, Michael?
Just have bounds.
We just have inequalities at the moment. So I don't know that we can read off too much. But with enough work, I mean, I think it's purely a calculation that would need to be done to figure out what the correction is.
Well, how about the scaling of the correction?
Okay, so there are worst case and best case situations, right? So we have bounds where this is just a general graph, right? And then it's very pessimistic that in order to get this term to go to zero, you actually need, you need D, capital D, or I don't know if you need it, but you know, what we can prove is that D has to scale exponentially in the volume, I think, right? And exponentially in the number of vertices. It's terrible.
Oh.
It's huge, right? But this is a worst case bound for a general graph that has no structure, right?
So
then if you go to some lattice situation, right, then you can start to use the statistics of the Ising model. And then I think we can rigorously prove that D goes as some power of the volume instead of exponentially in the volume. Right, so the number of cube, but it's still growing with the volume.
Yeah.
So that's actually a defect. But these are, again, just inequalities, right? So it could very well be that n doesn't have to scale with the volume at all. But we can't prove that right now.
Can't you just do a kind of, isn't there just some sort of Pyrrhel's type argument here to argue that you compare the statistics of the choice of gamma to the exponential suppression for making the length longer?
Maybe we should talk about it offline. It would be worth discussing. I mean, we haven't been able to nail it all the way into the ground yet. Other questions?
Yes, so I understand that in some higher order gravities, there's a version of Ryu-Takanagi where instead of integrating the area functional, scalar curvature also comes in.
Another
combination of area and scalar curvature that you're supposed to minimize across the cut.
Right.
I'm wondering if you can tune your construction to see these kind of level up geometries.
It's a good question. So is it scalar curvature in the vicinity of some surface?
I think it's the scalar curvature on the cut itself.
The intrinsic one.
Intrinsic.
Okay. I mean, it seems plausible that might appear, but I mean, I don't know. Precisely for the kind of argument that you were suggesting earlier. Okay, I think I'm running out of my time. So I just want to make a couple of points here. One which touches on something that people have brought up before. This is Haar averaging, right? Averaging with respect to the unitarily invariant measure. But as you've pointed out, we only ever calculate low order moments, right? And so if you take instead the psi i's, as random stabilizer states, Now, this is in a slight generalization of the stabilizer formalism that you're familiar with, which is all about qubits. But you can do the same thing in higher dimensions, where you replace the x operator, by a shift, right, and the z by its Fourier transform. So, if we use that stabilizer formalism in a situation where the dimension is a power of a prime, then that has the consequence that entropy is equal to an integer times the log of the prime. Right? So for these stabilizer states, the reduced density operators are always proportional to projectors, and the rank of the projector is the power of that prime. Right? And that means that the entropy is quantized in big steps. Right? And so the same averaging applies, but now you're saying that the average value of the Reni 2 entropy is close to its maximum possible value. Right? But the possible values of that Reni entropy are quantized in big steps, which means most of the time it is equal to the maximum possible value. So this implies that the entropy is actually equal to the minimum over gamma A of boundary gamma A times N. And this is now exact. Right, so there are, in the case where you actually talk about random stabilizer states in prime power dimension, there is no correction here. So that you actually get Ryu Takayanagi sort of satisfied exactly. And that has nice consequences for, say, quantum error correction type scenarios, where you want to know whether a certain map, in the Haar case, it would be approximately an isometry. In the random stabilizer situation, it's going to be exactly an isometry. Right?
Are you seeing why the power of the prime is important?
It has to do with the group theory of the stabilizer formalism, right? So
you need a finite field.
Oh, okay.
If that satisfies you, yeah. 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 Okay. So the last thing I want to say a little bit more about is, again, something that was foreshadowed, is the interpretation of this formula here in terms of the icing model, right? And you can probably guess how this goes. But we have some sum, a big sum, of d to the minus length of the boundary, right? So we could just say, well, this big sum here, it's a sum over these subsets of the C vertices, right? So what I could just do is assign a plus 1 to the elements that are in the sum, a minus 1 to the elements that are not in the sum, right? So I'll say and I'll write this as e to the minus beta h. Right? And what is beta going to be? Beta will be our logarithmic dimension, the n factor over there. And our Hamiltonian is just going to be a ferromagnetic icing model. But to get what we want, somehow A has to make an appearance, right? Because we're summing over subsets of vertices that include A. And the way that manifests itself is that we actually have to include a field that sort of pins the boundary vertices in the right direction. So it'll be a sum over now I in. Hmm? Oh, yeah, thanks. A union B, 1 minus HI SI, where HI is equal to plus 1 if I is an A, and minus 1 if I is an B. Right? So up to some normalization, overall global addition of some constant here, these things on the left and the right are equal. And this gives us a nice intuition for where these minimal surfaces are coming from, which is just that if we have some boundary which we partition into A and B, on the A side we put the pinning field up, in B we put this pinning field down. And then in the bulk, we have to assign vertices to be either up or down, right? And what's naturally going to happen is they're going to be up, you know, where the pinning field is located. And then, at least if the temperature is low enough, we'll be down where the down pinning field is located. And there'll be some domain wall separating the two, right? And the if the temperature is low enough, the ordered phase is going to dominate, and the domains are going to be separated by a minimal surface, right? So high D is the same thing as low temperature, which implies you're in the ordered phase. And so this actually gives a sort of a nice way of thinking about a number of situations, more complicated situations that are going to come up. That if you're a condensed matter physicist and like thinking in terms of the Ising model, you can really sort of set up your write your problem in the language of the Ising model. One thing we also know is, for example, at least on the square lattice, that this phase the ordering phase transition happens at some fixed temperature, which is of course independent of the size of the system, which suggests to us that our bound here is too weak, right? Where we actually have to take D scaling with the system size, but we haven't managed to nail all that down yet.
I would have thought that you would have magnetic fields for the sites which are adjacent to A's and adjacent to B's.
Adjacent to A's.
Like the sites A. Are not actually should not be fluctuating, right? And the field should just be for.
Yeah, I mean, so I think you can probably write this also as having some, you know, again, if you normalize a property properly, having some lambda here, which you make really large, which forces them.
It seems that you could do it without any pinning, but just putting the only dynamical degrees of freedom are associated to the C.
Oh.
And then you just have a magnetic field. Which says that
right.
You'd like to have the C populated if it's next to
yeah, I mean, I think you probably can write it that way.
I don't understand how this one is correct, but
you don't understand how this one is correct.
I think what Shaggy's saying
is... constant, right? A large constant.
Sorry?
Just might be a
there may be a constant missing?
Of this pinning term.
You want to put it here?
So that it effectively... Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. You either have to put an infinity there, or you have to do what Doug is saying.
Yeah,
so
maybe.
Plus one infinity, then like another.
Okay, I mean, I think it may actually work without that, you know, just through some averaging, but let's just put it in for good measure. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know what you could do with it, but just kind of an observation. This looks exactly like what mathematicians have studied in. We call it like SLE, Shem-Lubner evolution. In the case of like criticality, where they study these domain walls and like the probability distribution of them and fractal dimension of them, and it's related to central charge of the corresponding CFT and all that. I don't know if you'd be able to do anything with that, but it's exactly the same thing where they would usually study in the half plane where they'd map like the pinning like the endpoints is the origin end to infinity in the half plane, and would have pinning like up. On the left.
Okay, I mean that might be a useful hint that they might have, good techniques for analysis to get some of the bounds that we haven't managed to get yet. So thanks, but I think I should probably hand off now if there are no more questions to Sepper, who's going to follow up and tell you something about how this works, how this gives codes, how you incorporate bulk fields, and where the Hawking page transition comes from. Shall I leave this up?
Just one last question.
Yeah.
Is D equal to 2 because it's the smallest fractal phase?
If D is equal to 2?
D equal to 2 small enough to enter the disordered phase.
Yes. No, D equals 2, I think, is actually technically already in the ordered phase.
So that's kind of unfortunate. So you can't rate, you can't.
Yeah, no, you can't tune it to see. But there's another phase transition actually with the in there, a roughening phase transition for the. Okay. So you can study that one potentially.
Patrick, for you, that line proportional, the I plus F CI swap. Did you drop the higher order term in the hard average because it's higher order in one over V squared or something?
There is no higher order term. I dropped a normalization constant.
I thought the hard average has normally, there's a term that's like 1 over the dimension, and there's a term that's like 1 over the dimension squared. When you do an average for of UU, U dagger, U dagger.
I guess it's because we.
So, the denominator is going to have something of that form, like a product of D and D plus 1. I mean, it depends what you're averaging. Like here, it's kind of special because we're just averaging a pure state. In general, the coefficients would in front of them would have some structure. Usually, they'd have some structure like you're talking about.
Yeah.